Hello, I'm Sahil Mirza and welcome to this episode in Season 2 of Voices of Care. My guest today is Professor David Lawton, Group Chief Executive at Royal Wolverhampton and Walsall NHS Trusts. David, it's a privilege to have you on Voices of Care. Thanks for making the time to travel down to London to meet us.
Pleasure, it's good to be here.
It's extraordinary to think about because I look at your career and I've followed your career for a long time. It's I think it's your 20th health secretary that you're under. Yes, I've checked it up since 1986. And in your time, you've set up a medical school, raised finance for a hospital, the odd merger here and there. And it is with some sadness from all of us, I guess, but from you, your point of view, you've announced that you're now moving on from the NHS. Can you tell us a little bit about that and just some of the stuff that's going on at the trusts that you're leading?
Well, I've decided I'm 17 January, and I think it's time I, you know, spent more time with my wife. I'll be really sad to go because I've worked with a number of people for many, many years, and some of my colleagues, they'll be personal, lifelong friends, and so I'll be sad to go. But you know, I think now is the time that's right for me. It's also a good time from the trust point of view because I took over as chief exec at Walsall Healthcare 2.5 years ago. We've really done some great things there, and you know, I'm leaving everything in pretty good shape apart from the finances. You know, I have to say to myself that I have had a surplus every year for the last 15 years, and this year I've got a deficit. And you know, at the 31st of March, I managed to have a surplus, and on the 1st of April, I had a thumping great deficit. So there's something fundamentally wrong with the finances in the way that it's working currently.
Well, we're going to come and touch upon that. One final thing about the trust. I think Wolverhampton, it's your 20th anniversary in 2024, and extraordinary turnaround there as well. And just very briefly, there's a new vision and for the trust, a joint vision, the four C's, etc. So you're leaving at a time where I think the future is very much focused in terms of increasing patient care and delivery.
Yeah, the focus is on care, and I've always had that focus, you know, for the last 20 years. It's also about colleagues because, as you said in your introduction, workforce is a key issue. We do extremely well. I've got about 2% vacancy rate, which is really, really good, but I really work very, very hard to actually achieve that. And obviously now with collaboration, all four of the acute trusts in the Black Country collaborate in a way that they haven't done before. We've got a lot of shared services, so collaboration is the actual key. And then obviously communities, you know, we serve one of the most deprived communities in the country and got some real issues. So we have to do everything that we can to improve the health of our communities. But that is a long, long journey.
Well, it's a tremendous legacy, if I may say so. And turning to that issue around workforce, before we go into some of the broader issues affecting the NHS and to draw on all your extraordinary experience, the Health Foundation recently said it's the most serious crisis in the NHS history. You've got a very broad perspective, 125,000 vacancies. We're not even going to talk about social care, approaching now 8 million waiting list. Just from your perspective, you've been around this track many times, where's the scale sitting? Is it one of the very worst? We're really approaching something that you haven't quite seen before?
Well, I would agree with you. In social care, it's a real crisis of being able to get people because of the pay rates, because of the conditions, etc., etc. And as a generalisation, the NHS has got a problem, but in my organisations, you know, I don't have a significant problem. And it's probably worth me taking you back, actually.
Please.
To when I started in Wolverhampton, I had a 52 million deficit and I had to sort that out. It was also the third worst trust in the country for infection prevention. And, you know, the director of nursing one day came in the office, closed the door, and said, you'll never sort this infection problem out until you stop using agency nurses. And it was in 2005 in Wolverhampton that it was the 1st of December, we said we will not use any agency nurses, and I haven't used any to this day. and then 2.5 years ago I go into Walsall, and I said to the director of nursing, we're going to stop using agency nurses within the next year. It took her 18 months, but you know, between you and I knew it would probably not be done in a year, but we've done it. And the reason I did it in Wolverhampton in 2005 was to be able to manage the infection prevention standards of nurses. You cannot do that if you're using, you know, lots of agency nurses. And I've taken that on in terms of, we've got our own clinical fellowship for doctors, and I've got a nurse fellowship, and you know, we can recruit people, and I think that's important. I put an enormous amount of effort into recruitment, and we've recruited 400 nurses into Walsall in the time that I've been there. Quite a lot of
them
in 2 years, international nurses, and that shows through. That last year Walsall achieved safe staffing levels, which is the first time it's done that in 7 years. And I'm not having a go at previous management, I'm just saying it needed, you know, a substantial recruitment of workforce.
And I think that's a lesson that is something that perhaps applies to the whole system.
Oh, it does.
And when we look ahead to stepping back, we've had a very important document. Now, your memory goes back a long way, but first time in probably a generation, we've had the long-term workforce plan published in June 2023. 360,000 new staff, clinical, non-clinical, 2.4 billion, all of these very big numbers. And it's important that we understand that that's not going to happen overnight. That's going to take a long time. What's your view? I mean, it's early days still.
I mean, it is a 15-year plan. Mm. And to recruit the people that we will need will probably take more than a decade. Mm. Because, you know, as I jokingly say, some of the doctors that we need going forward, they're just starting primary school. Yeah, it is a long, long journey. Mm. In terms of recruiting medical staff, and you know, it's an ambitious number, but I do think that there is an awful lot more that can be done here and now to improve the conditions. You know, I put an enormous amount of effort in to doing things for staff well-being. I mean, example, you know, I provide a £1.50 hot meal a day. I provide free tea and coffee when people come to work, and toast. You know, I mean, if you'd have said to me a few years ago, I would be setting up a food bank and providing, you know, getting my catering people to get down to £1.50 so people, because we've had COVID and then we've got into a cost of living crisis. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And the cost of living crisis, it's not just the people who are not well paid in the NHS that are suffering. Some of the reasonable earners are suffering because, you know, they mortgage themselves because they're not as old as me. And, you know, I can remember interest rates at 17% when I was a lot younger.
Absolutely.
And we've got a generation of people that have been brought up on low interest rates, and it's been a real shock to see interest rates climbing in the way they have. So it's not just the people who are not well paid that are suffering. I think a lot of NHS staff are. So I see it as really important to up our well-being offer, and they're just some examples of what we've actually done, and then that shows through in the staff satisfaction.
Yes,
and your ability to recruit people.
And it's extraordinary to say the NHS plan, that's a 15-year plan, it's going to be looked at every 2 years. We needed that, and I think it's to be applauded. But as you say, you can't recruit yourself out of a retention crisis looking at the whole system. But I guess from what you said, these seemingly small steps make a big difference in retaining staff, because we've had significant numbers leave the NHS.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just retaining staff, it's also, I see as one of my key priorities is to recruit as many local people as I can. Mm. And, you know, I've got a massive catering production unit producing 30,000 meals a day. That's how I can say to the catering manager, you make sure you can get down to providing a hot meal for £1.50. Right? But the other thing to that is I employ a lot of local people in that production kitchen. And so you're providing jobs for people, because across Walsall and Wolverhampton, I'm the largest employer, employing 18,000 people. We've also done a lot with people who've been long-term unemployed, to get them in to get some work experience. And about 70% end up getting permanent jobs as well.
And that makes a huge difference in terms of the role of the anchor institution for the NHS. And I guess in that way, tackling that big issue, which I know is very close to your heart, you mentioned it earlier, we've had loads of evidence suggesting inequalities are rising. And whatever you can do to turn the dial on that's a big question. But being an employer and giving opportunity to people, I guess, is something you should be really proud of.
If you want to sort things out, you know, it's education and then it's employment. And being the largest employer, I mean, we've got 63 different disciplines. Everyone thinks about the NHS as being doctors and nurses. Yeah, they're important, but, you know, there's a lot of other people who are also important. I was talking the other day to some people who came on work experience, and they were quite surprised that I employ 11 photographers, right? And medical illustration is a very key thing for photographing, well before we started dermatology in terms of photographs. And there's a serious side of it as well, and that is in terms of safeguarding, that, you know, I've got to have the ability to call a photographer out at midnight to go and take some photographs, because they've got to be professionally done, because it's got to stand up in a court of law. You don't do it on your mobile phone.
No, absolutely.
So it's really very, very professional.
No, absolutely.
And there's lots of things like that that people don't think about.
No, I'm glad you brought them out, because I think we have to look at the broader picture. I wanted to turn to the bigger themes now that are afflicting the NHS and some of the solutions that you've instigated in your career, particularly the turnarounds going back all the way to Coventry, Warwickshire, mergers, etc. Funding is a big issue. Now, Nuffield Trust produced some stats showing that if you adjust for population and structure, the NHS on average for 40 years prior to the pandemic was growing at 2.6% per annum, real terms. But in the decade prior to the pandemic, that had gone down to 0.4%. Now, we'll talk about financial turnaround. That is the fundamental context in which the NHS is operating now. The last 10 years or so have been extraordinary in terms of the pressure to deliver financial surplus and indeed services within the financial constraints.
Well, as I say, up until the 31st of March this year, I delivered a surplus every year. But, you know, this year we're going to be in deficit. So, yeah, funding is an issue going forward. And all we can do, and I think some of it goes back to what I say around collaboration, right? There's now lots of opportunities to collaborate in a way that I haven't seen in more or less the whole of my career. You know, one payroll function across, I do payroll for a number of NHS organisations, procurement, you know, it's quite amazing what you can do in terms of procurement once you collaborate. I mean, I'm in a procurement arrangement with University Hospitals of North Midlands and others. And, you know, when you talk about getting into collaboration, we collaborate with all of the adult heart surgery centres in the country, all 29, and, you know, we jointly procure heart valves. So, you know, you can get a massive saving when you're actually procuring for a whole country. So I think, yeah, there's financial pressures.
But there are solutions to them.
There's some solutions to them, and that is driven out of collaboration, which hasn't been there for years.
No, and on that point, because you've obviously seen the Health and Care Act and the statutory foundation of integrated care systems, I was reminded, preparing to talk to you, Baroness Sirota said in 1970, our policy is to unite the NHS and its services and integrate them to locally, regionally. It's taken a long while to get there, but there is, as you say, opportunity now. And if you can leverage collaboration at scale, that can help financial performance, but also in terms of workforce, because you're giving them a broader opportunity perhaps as well.
Yeah. I mean, my organisation in Wolverhampton, we manage tertiary services, secondary care, and I've got a number of GP practices and community services. Mm-hmm. And I manage community services in both Wolverhampton and Walsall. And what we've been able to do with Hospital at Home, mm-hmm. and you know, we can get a district nurse into someone's house within 2 hours. So, and we also have people working in West Midlands Ambulance Control Room, so we can try and stop transporting patients to hospital by offering them the services from Hospital at Home, and that goes down really well with patients, and it's created the equivalent of 270 beds. So I wouldn't like to think where I would be today without what my community services have actually done. And I was there on Friday in the control room, and it's absolutely tremendous, and patients actually like it. I mean, I remember as well when my mother was alive and she was unwell, she'd always say, "Don't take me to that hospital, I won't come out."
Yeah. Wise words from
wise words from my mother.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's been this.
So, I mean, if you can get district nurses and community services into someone's home, people would rather stay at home than be taken to hospital when there is alternatives. Obviously, hospital is the right thing at the right time. But as I say, I think the collaboration, and I've managed community services for well over a decade.
So going back all the way to the 5-year forward view, etc.
Yeah. And I think that integration of tertiary care, secondary care, primary care, and I mean, my GP practices have less hospital admissions and less A&E attendances than the others.
That's an extraordinary.
The King's Fund evaluated that for me actually independently. So I do really do think, you know, there's got to be some working together in the way that primary care works with secondary care. That, as I say, there's places in the country are doing it, but I think it needs to be more across the board.
Because that ultimately is the direction of policy if you look at the long-term plan, etc., etc. And as you say, patients want it more. And possibly there may be opportunity now with the, if we get the integrated care systems right, for social care to play a part as well, local authorities to work together with the NHS.
Well, I mean, I've got a non-executive director on my board who is a director of social services, and I think that working together of social services is so important. And, you know, we do pretty well in terms of delayed discharges, but I do fear for the future, actually, in terms of social care and the way that it's funded, the way that it's managed. You know, it's going to be really, really difficult going forward to get the people.
I hope whoever the next government is will perhaps take some lesson from that, but the past history is not giving me a tremendous confidence.
We've been going to reform it for years.
We'll be back talking about the Royal Commission next 20 years ago. Bringing this together a little bit, what you've shared, what you've done in terms of primary care, tertiary and acute across the trust, at a surplus with an extraordinarily low vacancy rate. Leadership is going to be quite an important part of that. People talk about leadership as a soft skill. I think it's a lot more than that. And I wanted to talk about a couple of things under that, if I may. The NHS has had a number of its crises. Some of us will remember the Bristol Royal Infirmary 25 years ago, mid Staffordshire, of course. You know that very well from being somebody, I think, was brought in to help turn that around. Leadership is going to be really important as the NHS deals with this complex landscape of ageing population, growing needs. So talk to me a little bit about that, because there's a skill that's required in that. Amanda Pritchard spoke in November this year to the Health and Social Care Committee about the fact that leadership is patchy in terms of the development. It's a really important part of what you've delivered.
Yeah, I mean, I think in all fairness, I'm probably last of a generation, actually. You know, Sir Robert Naylor, Sir Andrew Cash, Sir Len Fenwick, to name but a few.
Legendary names.
So you are seeing, new people coming in. But I think the most important thing in terms of leadership is to understand what motivates your workforce. And, you know, I can talk until I'm blue in the face. I never talk to my staff about money because you're just wasting your time. And going back to what I've done, certainly in Wolverhampton and it links partly to mid-staffs as well.
Mm.
You know, my mortality a long time ago, 15 years ago, used to be at 120. I'm now at 90. I've got one of the lowest mortality rates in the country. And that's how you motivate people, to provide good quality care. And then the money comes out.
Mm. Mm.
You don't have to. And, you know, I can say that that has really, you reduce your mortality, because it's quite simple. You know, you stop harming patients, you save money. And I can remember back in the bad old days when I was the third worst in the country for infection prevention. I used to, I think I was once heard saying, you know, we kill 212 people a year with C. diff, and they take on average 21 days to die. And during that 21 day, you spend a fortune on them. So it's not good for the patient, and it's not good for the finance director. So the way to motivate staff is to deliver high quality care, and high quality care is cheaper. And also the other important thing that, you know, as you've mentioned mid-staffs, I got the best deal out of mid-staff possible, because everyone's heard of Stafford Hospital, nobody's heard of Cannock Hospital.
Mm.
And I got Cannock Hospital when it was broken, when mid-staffs was broken up, and it's a fabulous, fabulous elective centre. I've got 10 operating theatres there, loads of orthopaedic wards, ophthalmology, renal, and it hasn't got an A&E department, and it hasn't got any emergency medicine. So I know, come the first week of January, we will be carrying out elective orthopaedic procedures at Cannock Hospital. Probably not many hospitals in the country will be able to do that. So that is really, really good. And the other thing that you can really motivate staff with to employ them, I mean, I host clinical research for the whole of the West Midlands. Mm. And I've just had that contract renewed till 2030. And being able to recruit high quality professors, and then you get teams in behind them, is really, really beneficial to your whole recruitment package. And going back to the sort of recruitment, I mean, I've got no vacancies currently for GPs, right?
Wow.
Well, it's simple. I can offer portfolio careers. Right?
Absolutely.
That you can work six sessions in primary care. Well, no, sorry. You can work four sessions in primary care. You can work two sessions in the hospital, virtually in the specialty of your choice, right? And then you can have three sessions at the university to study for a higher qualification. And if you do the numbers on that, that's cheaper than employing agencies.
So that's going to help.
So you're giving away sessions at the university, right, to get no clinical benefit from it, but if you do the numbers, you save money.
It seems fiendishly simple. You talked about you're the last of a generation, and some of us can remember the Griffiths report from about 40 years ago that brought talent from outside the NHS to lead it. We've had 40 years later General Gordon Messenger's report around leadership. Looking ahead, as you leave the NHS, what would you recommend in terms of fostering the attitude you're talking about? Because we are going to need extraordinary leaders as the service transforms.
Seeing as you mention it, it's quite interesting to think back to 1985 when Sir Roy Griffiths, who was the then deputy chairman of Sainsbury's, did the report for Margaret Thatcher, and basically said if Florence Nightingale was walking the wards of the NHS, she wouldn't work out who was in charge.
Mm.
Because at that time there was an administrator, a doctor and a nurse, and they had to reach decisions by consensus.
Mm.
It's really quite interesting for me, actually, because I've got a really well-developed clinical directorate structure, and basically, on the face of it, the doctor, the nurse and the manager are all equal.
Mm.
Right? And they work things out together. And you know, I've done doctors in management since 1989. I was one of the national pilots. And I think in many ways, what was said to be wrong with the NHS at that time is something that we've developed over the years of people actually working together and appreciating one another's viewpoint. But the point you make about managers going forward, it's going to be key over the short term, the well-being offer to staff and recruitment. And, you know, although I employ nearly 1,000 consultants, I am on at least 90% of consultant interview panels. Sometimes I can do 3 a week.
Personally,
because, you know, it's the way that you attract people, right? You know, if they can't see the boss and they're going to be committing to the organisation for 25, 30 years, and, you know, I've got plenty of evidence to show that, you know, my discussions with people before the interview attracts them to want to come there, and then when I'm on the interview panel, along with a lot of other people, they say, yeah, we're special, we want you to come here.
And that goes back very briefly, we don't spend our time in history, but Berwick, a Berwick review, talked about you can't rely on regulation to change things. No. It's about the culture. And so actually it's to sell a vision as well. So that's going to be part of the goal.
I mean, that culture, when I went to Wolverhampton, as you've already said, it had a massive deficit. Mm. And before I was interviewed, I went out for dinner with about 5 of the senior people because I wanted to work out what the culture was like. Because I can sort money, I'm not bad at that. Culture is a long journey, and I think we've got a fabulous culture, and that actually starts, I'll give you an example, we've got the highest rating of satisfaction of medical students from the medical school. We currently have got the highest rating in the country on the GMC survey for doctors in training. So happy medical students want to come back as doctors in training, and happy doctors in training want consultant jobs. Job done. But that is a long, long journey, because you've got to get a culture where, you know, the consultants don't chew a doctor in training's ear off at 2 o'clock in the morning for phoning them.
It's a remarkable observation, because as you know, the stats are showing from the GMC's own survey tremendous levels of burnout and stress amongst trainees. And you talked about that very briefly, we'll touch upon that. That wellness offer, that well-being offer, is incredibly, we may be post the pandemic restrictions, but people are still very much under a stress and burnout threat.
Yeah, I don't think it's just the work. Right, you know, people do not leave their financial problems at home, right? And a lot of people have got financial problems. Their life's been affected by the cost of living crisis. So I think you've got to take that into account as well.
Oh, I completely agree. A couple of final questions. You've seen the odd reorganisation and restructure in your time. Somebody, someone who can remember area health authorities and strategic health authorities. One of the key aspects is to have some stability, I guess, in the NHS in terms of allowing it to flourish. I mean, we've had politicians, Wes Streeting as an example from the Labour Party, saying that the NHS must reform or die. What's your view when you hear these type of things, when the NHS has been through enormous numbers of changes and restructuring?
Well, as you say, I've seen enormous changes to the system, and I just remind myself there's only been 2 stable parts of the system since 1948. At one end you've got GPs, at the other end you've got hospitals. The bit in the middle gets reorganised fairly regularly, but it is that working together of the two bits. And, you know, I've had a GP on my board for 30 years, right? If you don't understand what the GP's issues are, and certainly with the with the GP practices I manage, we have multidisciplinary meetings between hospital consultants and the GPs, because we have identified the patients who are in the last 12 months of life. It's not an exact science, by the way, I'm sure you'll appreciate that, but once you've done that and then you have a proper care plan in place that can be seen at 2 o'clock in the morning if the patient's brought into A&E, and it can be seen in the GP surgery. I mean, when I take on GP practices, I wish we hadn't done it, but NHS England at first insisted that I tell the patients we were going to share information, and we send them a letter saying, I'll make the date up from the 1st of January, the information the GP has on you is going to be shared with the hospital, and the information the hospital's got on you is going to be shared with the GP. And people, we get some letters back saying, don't you do it already?
One final point, if I may, David, observation. The NHS, British Social Attitude Survey, been around for 40 years. The NHS, unfortunately, for the public, has the lowest satisfaction record it's ever had, when it had its highest one in 2010, a few years after the Wanderlust report, of course. But at the same time, the commitment to the principles of the NHS are rock solid in terms of the NHS. With that background, perhaps I'd love to give you the platform now at the end of such an illustrious career with so many achievements. What makes you most proud of the NHS, and what perhaps would you advise those that are going to come after you
in order to make sure? I mean, I've been really proud. It's been a privilege to be part of the NHS for so long. I think certainly in the last 12 months, I have seen the most difficult time. You know, we've got 8 million people on NHS waiting lists, and I think the industrial action with doctors has damaged the view of doctors with the public. And, you know, I could give examples, but I'm not going to. You know, I think the doctors, you know, saying they wanted 35%, no one can get their head around that. And also industrial action and people being told on multiple occasions your appointment is being rescheduled. So I think that I've seen in the last 12 months with this industrial action, you know, a lowering of the public's opinion of doctors, and that worries me actually.
Well, let's hope that may be transformed in the light of the great legacy you've left at Wolverhampton and Walsall. David Orton, thank you so much for your time and your characteristic candour and passion.
Thank you. Absolute pleasure.
The pleasure is ours, absolutely, David.
Thank you.
If you've enjoyed this episode of Voices of Care, please like, follow, or subscribe wherever you receive your podcasts. And if you want to find out more about how we are enabling the healthcare workforce of the future, please visit newcrosshealthcare.com/Voices of Care. In the meantime, I'm Sahil Mirza. Thank you very much, and look forward to seeing you on the next episode.